Good afternoon, Fritz Bergeron, bloodandfaith.com. It's the 25th of July. Yesterday I talked about the guilt manipulation that white people are under, where they're burdened with sins. They're burdened with their own sins. They're burdened with the sins of their ancestors. They're burdened with guilt, this enormous sense of guilt that's put upon them by their religious leaders. And back in the day, back in when I was in schools, you couldn't go through school and not hear from your teachers, your professors, about how the Puritans were this horrible people that just burdened the people down with guilt. And it really wasn't true, but it didn't matter. That's how they presented it. And they loved to, you know, talk about the Scarlet Letter and people condemning people for engaging in adultery, and the, you know, you do the public shaming on them. And you can't go through school in America and not learn that stuff, and be impressed by your teachers, your cult leaders, with how evil those people really were. And I said in there that this generation owes an apology to the Puritans, because the amount of guilt and shaming and public humiliation that's put on white people today is orders of magnitude way beyond what the Puritans put on the people that engaged in adultery, for example. You have cult leaders. You have the moral leader, the self-appointed moral leaders of the United States of America and in Europe, but let's just stick with the United States. And they go around beating on white people with their cudgels, flailing against them in the moral sense, telling them what a horrible people they are because they're the R word. Forget the A word. Forget the Scarlet Letter. This is now the R word. And it's the substitute for that, it's the morality of it. And white people are told that they are fundamentally flawed, fundamentally racist, and fundamentally incapable of truly repenting for the sins of some distant people that lived in the past. And therefore, they need to bear that burden of sin constantly and forever. You have people going on CNN, and they will talk about how, you know, even well-meaning liberal white people who say all the right things and do the right things and participate and support Black Lives Matter, even they have this virus of racism deep in their soul that can never be expunged. And, you know, this is what the Protestant Reformation was all about. This is what Martin Luther railed against. The Catholic Church, okay, the Protestant Reformation, 1517, Martin Luther's 95 Theses, he nailed them to the cathedral door at Wittenberg. And basically, Martin Luther said, listen, church, Catholic Church, because that was the only church, that was the church. He said, you can't just morally manipulate people for their lives, and you put these sins upon them, and you put this load upon their backs they cannot bear. And you say you must bear this sin, and in order to prove that you're not a sinner, you need to give more money, and you need to crawl on your knees, and you need to go on pilgrimages, and you need to go confess your sins, and have this sort of bearing your shame and your guilt in public and in private and never ending was how you were supposed to get through life. And Martin Luther comes along, he said, no, we're saved by faith. We're saved by faith alone. We have faith in Jesus Christ. We don't carry those sins anymore. We don't bear that burden. It's all washed away. And that was the beauty and the joy of Protestantism. It's Jesus Christ that bore our sins. And that needs to be lifted. That needs to be gone. You don't control us anymore. You don't control us. And the Protestant movement relied upon individual human beings reading the Holy Scriptures for themselves. In the Catholic Church, the church back in 1517, people didn't read the Bible. They couldn't read the Bible. First of all, they were illiterate. Second of all, it was written in Latin. Maybe they spoke Latin. Maybe they didn't. Maybe they spoke some form of French, or they spoke German or English. And so they didn't read the Bible. And so they relied upon their religious leaders to tell them what was in the Bible. And, of course, this is why you had the great cathedrals in the Middle Ages, which were full of the iconography. It was full of statues and stained glass windows to paint pictures of Mary and Jesus and the angels and God and the judgment day in heaven, and in order to frame that worldview for them. The Protestant Revolution fundamentally changed that. First of all, Luther and the other Protestants says, we're not going to bear these sins anymore. We can't bear these sins. We're not going to live this way. Jesus Christ set us free from bearing that burden of sin. He bore his sins in his body on a cross. We don't have to walk around with our heads hung down in shame all the time, constantly trying to make up for what we didn't do right and what we did do wrong. He said, that's not the gospel. That's not the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's not freedom. And in addition to that, part of the great Protestant movement that was that individual human beings could actually read the scriptures for themselves. Wow. Wow. What a concept. And that even preceded Martin Luther. You had the Lollards going about England teaching, can you imagine this, teaching Englishmen how to read English so that they could read the scriptures. You had the King James Bible, which was put out by King James, 1611, in order so that individual people could read the Bible for themselves. And they would put a Bible in a church, and they would chain it to something in the church so it wouldn't be stolen, because back then you couldn't whip out, you know, 50 Bibles in a half an hour in these modern printing presses. It was a lot of work, and and the Catholics didn't like that, because then you lose control. Now people have direct access to God, and they have direct access to the Word of God. That's a pretty powerful concept, and people don't have to go around in shame trying to do things to lift the burden of their sins off of them. The Protestant Reformation said, no, we are not going to be shamed and be cowed and cudgeled and beaten with sins that we can never redeem, and have to give more money to have our sins released, and have to go on pilgrimages and crawl on our knees and confess to the priest, and it's never enough. It's never enough. And you know, they could only rely upon the priest on what the truth was, because they didn't have access to the Holy Scriptures. And that whole movement in Northern Europe was to get the Scriptures in the hands of people so they could read it for themselves, and to lift the burden of sin and guilt off the backs of people. And that was, gosh, man, that was liberty. That was liberty. And so from that, you had the Pilgrims, you had the Puritans. And they said, we're not going to participate in this cultic system anymore, that we're never free. We're always in bondage. And that was it's a political movement as much as it's a spiritual movement, because the way I look at the world is you can't distinguish between the two. Attempts to distinguish between religion and politics are simply a means to segregate certain ideas and exclude them from the political sphere. And that's it's a powerful tactic. I have no qualms with the enemy wanting to win the war, but I don't have to accept the rules. So when they say, keep church and state separate, what they really mean is the real world has to be expunged of all Christian ideas. That's really what their intent is. I don't have to play by that rule. I don't have to agree with that. They demand it, but don't impose your morality upon me. Don't impose your politics on me. I'll make that choice for myself. And if I want to support a law against murder, and I'm going to support a law against murder. It's part of the Ten Commandments. And they would say, if they're going to be logical, well, you can't do that because that's that's a Christian idea. It's a religious idea. You don't want religious ideas in politics. Well, you know. So you've got the Protestant Reformation said, we stop bearing us down and burdening us with this guilt. Okay, we're free. We've been set free by Jesus Christ. He bore our sins in his body on the cross, and by his stripes we've been healed. It was for liberty that Christ set us free. And we can read and know the scriptures for ourselves. I mean, this was a tremendous, tremendous change in the world. And it seems we've gone full circle on this now. We've gone full circle in it in Christendom. And by Christendom, I mean in Europe and Europe's children, whether it's Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States, where the white Europeans live that are traditionally Christian and especially Protestant. At some point in Europe, the church leaders, the university professors, decided that atheism was the way to go. It really began with the Enlightenment and the ideas that sprung out of the Enlightenment, including the French Revolution and Marxism. But they decided that freedom was actually slavery. They inverted everything, and that God was actually an oppressor. And so let's throw off the chains of God so that we don't have to obey anybody's law. And now you cannot go through the educational system and get an understanding of what the Holy Scriptures say. So it's in 500 years, in 500 years, you've gone from, oh my God, people can actually read the Scriptures for themselves, to, oh my God, you can't talk about the Bible in public schools. You can't teach it. It needs to be fundamentally excluded from politics and education. So we've gone full circle in 500 years. We've also gone full circle on guilt manipulation. In the Protestant Revolution, the Protestants said, we're not going to bear this guilt. We're not going to bear unending shame and guilt and sin. We're not going to do that. Christ bore that for us on the cross. We're going to leave it there, and we're going to walk away, and we're going to live in freedom. But now, oh no, you white people, you are the cause of all the sin and misery and horror in the world, and you need to bear this burden. You need to carry this on your backs forever, you and your children and your grandchildren forever, because you're the R word, you're the racist. Not, you know, we've talked about how they don't define it. It's just simply, it's a way of putting a burden on the backs of men for guilt. And these poor white people, they wander around in guilt and shame, just like they did in the Middle Ages. Just like they did before the Protestant Reformation. Wandering around in guilt and shame, whipping their own back, saying, woe is me, I'm the great sinner, I'm the great racist. And they feel they have to atone for the sins of ancient people somewhere. That's not liberty, man. That ain't freedom. Christ came to set us free from sin and death and guilt and shame. But no, you're going to reject Jesus Christ. Now you're going to bear this. Now you're going to bear this endless guilt and shame. And you know, shame on the Christian pastors. Shame on the Christian pastors who can't call this out for what it exactly is. It is putting upon the backs of people burdens that they cannot bear. Which is what the Jews did in Jesus Christ's time too. You're putting that guilt on people that they can't bear, and they won't bear it themselves. And the people can't bear it either. Now, you know, if you're not white, they say, we love this guilt because we don't have to bear it because we ain't white. And it's a way to extract rents from people for nothing. Rent is when you get money for something that you don't do, essentially. So if you own a house, somebody pays you money. And you say, well, you know, I had to work hard for that house. Well, they had to work hard to build this idea that white people are eternally guilty. They put the capital into it. They worked hard for generations to build this idea that white people are eternally guilty, and therefore they must eternally pay for these sins. And they extract rent. Well, we want free housing. We want more housing. We want preference in schools. We want preferences in education. And it's a way to extract wealth from those who have and give it to those who don't. And it's a way of putting a different people under slavery and bondage. And white people need to wake up to this. It's slavery in simply a different form. And of course, some white people say, "Well, we deserve it because we have those sins, when we can never get rid of them." Not me, baby. I ain't gonna live under bondage like that. Not gonna live under that bondage. Not gonna live under that slavery. Not gonna live under your guilt manipulation. Not gonna live under these burdens that God didn't call me to bear. That's a lie. And I'm telling the white people, you need to go back and take the yoke of Jesus Christ again. Otherwise, you're going to have this iron yoke on you and your children forever, and they will extinguish you. They will eventually extinguish you. And so that's not good. So we're talking, you know, we need to go back to the Protestant Reformation. We need to go back to the Protestant Reformation and decide that we're not going to walk around bearing sins for which, you know, we were not called to bear. And this is a very basic Protestant idea. And there you go. Fritz Bergeron, bloodandfaith.com, 25 July 2020. How do we solve this? Or can we solve this? So one of the conclusions I've come to in the last, I don't know, several years is that whatever we're doing doesn't work. It just doesn't work. You know, you can't live in peace and harmony when you're constantly trying to stir up anger and resentment and hate between one people group and another in the same country. And that's exactly what the religious leaders of the United States have done. And by that, I mean the moral and the political leaders, the university professors. They're beyond reach. They're beyond touch. You can't question them. You can't argue with them. You can't question their institution, and you can't question their truth, because to question their truth is to be a heretic. So they're the effective religious leaders of this national cult. And they've spent generations stirring up and imposing this guilt upon white people and stirring the divisions and the strife and the hatred and the anger. And if you don't believe me, go back and, you know, study Chaz. Study Chaz for a little bit. Find out what happened there. They had a little experiment in direct democracy, I guess. And at one moment, they had a big meeting in the park. And, you know, if you're white, you can't be a leader in that, of course, because you're part of the oppressive class. And he looked at all the white people. He said, listen, man, right now, you need to pull 10 bucks out of your pocket, 20 bucks out of your pocket right now, and turn around and find a black person, and give it to him. And if you can't do that, you're certainly not going to be willing to support the reparations that are coming. I don't know how you guys feel about that, but, you know, there's no sense of equal treatment under the law in that system. It's you end up building a system that is fundamentally against sort of everything in the Western experiment, where you have one sets of law for all the people. These are the laws. Everybody gets equal treatment under the law. That's the theory. And what they're doing is actually to create two sets of law. One sets of law for these people, another sets of law for those people. So, and, you know, reparations is part of it. It's not the only part of it, but that's certainly part of it. The other part of it is, you know, if you're not white, you're going to get preferential treatment for anything. If you're not white, you can make excuses for anything that goes wrong in your life. If you are white, well, you got no excuses. But how do you build a nation, a single nation state? Let's use the term country. How do you build a country where you're constantly pitting one group of people against the other? How do you build a multiracial country or a multi-religious country? And the experiment says that it doesn't work. And we're, you know, as we move, become more and more diverse, become the rainbow nation in the United States, the unity is being destroyed. There's no unity. Who's an American? What's an American? You've got some, you know, they want to tear down every symbol of America that's ever existed that we know as American. And, you know, we're the deplorables and the irredeemables. And so their answer is, well, we simply need to wipe those people out. And that's really what it comes down to. They need to wipe us white Christian Europeans out. Wipe our bloodline out. Wipe our history out. Wipe our ideas out. That's their answer. You know, they have no conception that somehow we can all get along. They don't want to get along. They want to win at all costs, by any means necessary. And they're open about it. They say it. If logic and rationality don't work, they go to emotion. If emotion doesn't work, they go to violence. What do you think these things in Portland and Seattle? They're violent. And if they win on the political realm, you haven't seen anything yet. You have no idea what's coming. I have an idea because I'm a student of history. I know what happened in Germany. I know what happened under Pol Pot in Cambodia in the 1970s. I know what happened under Mao under the Cultural Revolution. They told the young people, you need to go out and slaughter anybody that's got old ideas. And they did. They publicly shamed them, they humiliated them, they beat them, and they murdered them. And tens of millions of people died in their great experiment in under the Cultural Revolution in China. And that is unquestionably what's coming to Northern America. And the question is, you know, are white people going to go silently into the night and let themselves be extinguished? I think the answer is no. Whether, you know, my ideas take hold or not, I think the answer is no. I think there's enough people that aren't willing to go that way. So that's a good thing. So why can't we get along and get together? Well, we can't. I mean, we've built a system of guilt and shame and hatred and anger between the peoples, between the different groups. And there's no going back. You can't go back and rebuild this and somehow make us all one. Part of the reason is we're not one. Look, man, I ain't one with the Somalians from Somalia that are Muslims. Never going to be. And, you know, I wish them well. I really do. But I will never be a Muslim. I will never be Somalian. I will never be part of their people group, ever. It's not possible. And for somebody to pretend that they can be, you know, what kind of crack are you smoking? If you're a middle-aged, white, Christian, straight man, what are you thinking? Can I walk into downtown Detroit and... I was in Miami several, I think I mentioned this before, I was in Miami several years ago, and I had a very unpleasant encounter with five or six young, very large African-Americans, or whatever the term of the day is. Naive little Fritzy, thought I'd just wander in an elevator with these guys, and it was extremely uncomfortable. So I got it. I ain't you, you ain't me. It's okay. Let's recognize it. Let's walk apart. Let's step aside. Let's say, you know what? This ain't working out. Let's go our separate ways. You know, if you have a marriage and it comes to that point where it's absolutely irreconcilable, society says, hey, man, this ain't working. Y'all need to go your separate ways. It's going to be uncomfortable. It's going to be ugly. But you know, what you got going on now is unhealthy for you, for each other, and for the kids. And so, you know, society can do that to a marriage, but it seems to, we haven't figured out how to do that in the body politic, because it's not one body politic anymore, it's multiple. And we brought this upon ourselves by, you know, seeking after this diversity, as if diversity is a strength. No, it's not a strength, it's a weakness. It's fundamentally a weakness. You bring in the people that are fundamentally different, different worldviews, you can't get along. You can't get along in a marriage. How do you think you're going to get along in a nation? If you can't get along in a marriage, how are you going to get along in a nation? How can you walk together unless there's an agreement? How can you do that? How can you walk together unless there's an agreement? There's fundamental disagreement in this country on just the very basic on what's true, what's right, what's good, what's bad, what history we should have, what history we shouldn't. And the left is seeking to destroy that which America was, and by any means necessary. They've taken over the institutions of higher education, and now they're hitting out at the public symbols of our past and destroying them, and insisting that white people bear unending guilt and shame. Anyway, this doesn't work. This doesn't work. Either one side submits, or there's going to be no peace. And so this is why I'm saying, hey, look, man, let's just recognize it for what it is. Let's recognize it for what it is. This is a civil breakup. It's a civil divorce. And the sooner we recognize that and are able to handle that peacefully, the less violence there's going to be. The less violence there will be. But if both parties say, you know what, by any means necessary, we must take over the other half and destroy them because they are fundamentally evil, there's going to be a fight. There's going to be a big fight. There's going to be a big fight, and it's going to be ugly, because if there's no, you know, the United States Civil War was a horrible war, awful war, and I want to say, I can't remember, it was 18 or 20% of the military-aged men of the United States died during that war, and the human suffering was incredible. Innocent people suffer in wars. If you haven't been watching your TV screen in the last 20 years, innocent people always suffer in wars. If you don't want innocent people to suffer, don't go to war. Don't go to war. You don't think innocent people suffered when they took over Chaz in Seattle? Of course they did. They got caught in the middle of something they didn't want to be in. And if they're white, they're like, well, it serves you right, you're white. it just gets ugly. And so we've created a system in which it's not possible to get along anymore. So let's go our separate ways. Okay. And does that mean by race? Yeah, it does mean by race. Yes, it does. How can it not? I mean, that's what the left has said. It's all about race. That's what the left has insisted. They've insisted it's all about race. It's about race. It's about white guilt, white shame forever. It's about racism. And when they say racism, they mean white people. They're not talking about, you know, black people hating black people or black people hating. They're talking about white people. And, you know, when they demand equality, what they're saying is we want what you have. Whether you got it well or not, that's why they call it systemic racism. It's just another Marxist term used to extract from one party and transfer it to another. And they've built their moral arguments, and they're not backing down from it. And they will overturn the system if we let them. And dang it, we're doing a good job of letting them. If you had white people with guns doing what these Antifas and BLMs are doing, you don't think F-16s would have been dropping bombs on them by now? Of course they would, because you could call them white racists. But these folks can literally get away with murder, and it's all kid gloves. Kid gloves, man. No, they're just mostly peaceful protesters. Let them have their voice. And in a way, you know, they've got it figured out. I've studied this. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on how the revolution worked in Cuba in 1933. And you just keep pushing. And any attempt by the government to suppress that revolution simply fuels the fire, fuels the rage. And the government ends up with three choices. One, you can just step aside, let people walk all over you. Nixon kind of did that. He just resigned, walked away. Two, you can do halfway measures. That's what Machado did in Cuba, early 1930s. And what that does is it just, because there's no economic recovery, at that time, and people just get more and more upset. And things got worse and worse and worse. And then by the time Machado left you had some other, you know, intermediate revolutionaries running the show for a while and not doing very good. You had the Gang of Five. They didn't do very good at sorting things out for Cuba. Of course, this was the 1930s. It was a battle over the world. And then you had Batista come in, and he was a low-ranking army guy. And he ran the show for a while. Eventually, he walked away, too, because it was a big, fat mess. And then you had Castro march in, and he understood the lessons of history. And so what he did is he put people up against the wall and shot them. He says, we're not going to go ahead. I'm not walking away. I fought for this. I fought for this, and I won. Those guys gave up. And he says, I know from history, my own country, that halfway measures don't work. So he started putting people up against the wall and killed them. And then he let the people that really didn't want to be there go to Miami. And so we took over. And it's, 60 years later, Marxists are very much in power in Cuba. So there's not a good outcome on this. There's just not. If I wrote a blog post yesterday, and, I talked about how borders change over time. And I don't see any other way. And because of the way this whole thing has been framed as a race-based problem by the left. There's so many white people that want a good civic nationalism solution to this. You know, why can't we just be Americans? Well, what does it mean to be an American anymore? People don't even know the answer to that. What's an American? Is it somebody who holds a passport that says the United States of America in there? Is that it? What does that mean? That's not enough. That's not enough. If it's not enough in a marriage, you know, we got to think through this. It's going to come down to race, whether you or I want it or not. It already has. You already see it in Chaz. White people, we're going to press you. You need to turn over your $10 right now, because if you can't do that, you have no idea what's coming. And that's it. That's it. And so, Fritz Bergen, bloodandfaith.com, 25 July 2020. Okay, part three. Fritz Bergen, bloodandfaith.com, 25 July 2020. So let's pull back. We've gotten a little bit into the details on why this stuff doesn't work. Let's pull back and give you the full big picture. I mentioned a while ago that You know, when people pray for a homosexual couple because their marriage is failing, it doesn't. Where are your prayers going? There's no such thing as homosexual marriage in the eyes of God or in the examples of the scriptures. You can't ask God to bless what God is clearly abhorrent to Him. And so let's go back to, you know, what's the big picture on the mixing of races? Oh, yeah, I know, it's controversial. You betcha. It's controversial. So the folks get off the boat, right? The folks get off the boat with Noah. So Shem, Ham, and Japheth get off the boat. God's instruction is you need to spread out, fill the earth. Go fill the earth. Repopulate the earth, fill it. And fill it means, you know, don't just stay in one little corner. Spread out, fill it. What do they do? Oh, no, we know better than God. We know better than God. We're going to all come together in one place. We're going to build a single civilization, an urban civilization based around Babel. And we're all going to stay together lest we be spread abroad across the face of the earth. And this was abhorrent to God, so much so that he comes down and he confuses their tongues. This is the original gift of tongues right there. And he confuses them. And so the different bloodlines can't communicate to each other. You think that introduced some racial strife? I think it did. I think it introduced a lot of racial strife. All of a sudden, the bloodline of Eber can't get along with the bloodline of these other folks out there. And that's why they're speaking Hebrew. And these race-based groups, these bloodlines, spread out across the face of the earth. They took the technology that they learned from Shem, Ham, and Japheth, which was boat building, and they were able to spread out. And the Greek scriptures, it reemphasizes the legitimacy of this. Acts 17, he says, I caused the races to be spread out. I gave them their times and their boundaries. And the great experiment of rebellious mankind is to undo what God intended. And so Babel is our example. Acts is our supporting thing in the Greek scriptures. And let's go to Daniel, book of Daniel, where you've got the great statue, head of gold, the body of silver, and it goes down to bronze, and then the feet and the toes are iron mixed with clays. And you've got iron mixed with clay. You've got completely unassimilable substances trying to be mixed together. And right there, God says, this doesn't work. It doesn't work. You can't mix iron and clay, period. And it fails. It's right there in the scriptures. So as we try to experiment with a tolerant and diverse culture and expect it to live in peace, it's not possible. And it's not supported by the guidance we were provided with in the Hebrew and Greek scriptures. So the sooner we get over this and recognize this, we can go our separate ways. Good borders make good neighbors. But at the end of the day, let's wake up to reality. And the sooner we do that and we can go our separate ways in peace, the less likely this is going to end up in a bloody conflagration. Okay, let's we gotta wrap this up here. This is part four. What do you do about everybody that doesn't want to be part of this? What do you do with people that don't want to move into a racially homogenous area? I don't have a good answer for that. What do you do with mixed race people? I don't have a good answer for that. There's not necessarily a good answer. If you go down the road and you do a bunch of crazy things, you're going to end up with crazy stuff that doesn't have a good answer. And this is true in our personal lives. It's true in our social circles. It's true in our countries. And people are going to have to figure out their own place. There's a lot of self-hating white people out there that don't want anything to do with me or my politics or my religion. I got it. That's okay. You're going to have to find your place. But you've got to recognize we've reached the point where we all can't get along. And the bottom line is straight white Christian men have been compromising and moving farther and farther to the left in order to get along with the people from a different point of view. And the church has been just as guilty of that. And it's time to say, stop. We're done. We're done. We're not going to go that way. And so now, if we're not moving, and they're not going to stop moving, yeah, there's a conflict. There's a crash. So no, I don't have a good answer for the people that don't want to be in one place or the other. There is no simple solution to this. There really is not. But endless compromise and the willingness to be self-destructive for a white Christian people is no, over my dead body. Could be over my dead body, but I'm not willing to go there with that. And this is a call out to white folk one way or the other. You need to wake up. And it's a call out to all Americans to wake up. There is not a good outcome to this. And we need to look at this with clear eyes and say, how are we gonna approach this? Are we just gonna keep the blinders on and run headlong straight into each other and have a fight? Or are we gonna step back and say, yeah, there's no good outcome for anybody on this, and have more rational heads make some good decisions on this. My suspicion is that as these things get rolling, smart decisions just don't happen. And you can look at World War I, you can look at World War II, you can look at the U.S. Civil War, you can look at the Cultural Revolution in China. I'm not optimistic. Yeah. No good answers, folks. Fritz Berggren, bloodandfaith.com, 25 July 2020, out.